What if the secret to a lifelong love of your sport wasn't just in how you train your body? What joy, possibility, and performance could be unlocked through the power of mental fitness? Well, you're about to find out. Welcome to the MindFit Athlete Podcast. If you want to figure out what's holding you back, then you're in the right place. Now, here's your host, John Ray.
Welcome to the MindFit Athlete Podcast. I'm John. With me, as always, is Scott.
Hello, everyone.
And our beating heart and soul, Emily.
Hi, guys. I am so thrilled to be here with you both.
Today, we are talking about something that feels a lot like being handed the secret instruction manual to your own potential. We spend so much time fighting our bodies, don't we? Trying to force them to go faster, to go farther, to squeeze one more hard session into an already packed week. But is there a different way? Maybe we could stop fighting and start collaborating?
That's interesting. So many driven athletes treat their bodies like a machine they can just bully into submission. But to really see this differently, I want you to imagine your body as a high-performance sports car. You've got the engine, the chassis, the tires.
But connecting and integrating it all, making the whole machine sing, is an intricate network of electrical wiring. That is your nervous system. Let's break down this beautiful network and understand it better. We have to start with the central nervous system, or the CNS.
The command center.
Exactly. Think of your CNS as the ultimate command center, housed in your brain and spinal cord. It takes in millions of sensory whispers from the outside world. It processes them, and it decides how to keep you safe. For us as athletes, this is where our drive and our perception of effort actually live.
Right. So if the brain is the command center, what connects it to the rest of the car?
That would be the peripheral nervous system. This is the massive network of cables carrying messages back and forth from the brain all the way down to your toes.
Okay, and if I remember, the peripheral nervous system branches off into two different roads, the somatic system and the autonomic system?
It does. The somatic nervous system is the part you actively control. When you see a route on the trail and think, I'm going to jump over that, or you see the finish line and think, okay, now I'm going to sprint this.
Scott, can we just briefly dive into the details of this? Take your sprint finish example.
Okay, when you see that finish line and make the conscious, voluntary decision to sprint, that executive choice happens in your prefrontal cortex. Because this area is already the control center of your CNS, it immediately hands that intention over to the premotor cortex. The brain drafts a complex blueprint of the movement, figuring out exactly which muscles need to fire, in what sequence, and with what force to transition you from a jog to a full sprint. Once that blueprint is finalized, electrical signals travel down through the CNS. Deep within your spinal cord, the CNS hands the signal off to the lower motor neurons, which are your actual somatic nerves. These nerves exit your spine and travel all the way down your legs, directly to the specific muscles you need to use. When the electrical signal reaches the very end of the somatic nerve, the nerve releases acetylcholine, triggering the muscles to contract and propels you forward into your sprint.
Wow. You say it's a conscious, deliberate movement, but actually it's more like it's a conscious decision to undertake the action. And it's that decision that sets off a whole chain of events that ends in movements. I'm just so glad I don't have to consciously think of the thousands of sub-steps. Our bodies are miraculous, really.
That's a fair correction, Emily. But let's go back to the autonomic system. If you liked the somatic system, you are going to love the autonomic. For me, it's where the real magic happens for endurance athletes.
The word autonomic sounds a lot like automatic.
Yes, our autonomic nervous system controls everything in the background that's keeping you alive. Your heart rate, your breathing, your digestion.
And this autonomic system, this is where we find our sports car pedals, isn't it?
It is. You are thinking of two of the autonomic system's components, the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. But just let's back up a moment. While the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems get all the attention in training discussions because they control your heart rate and muscles, the autonomic nervous system is actually a triad. The third branch is the enteric nervous system. We won't talk about it today, but actually it's fascinating in its own right. It's a vast mesh-like network of neurons embedded in the lining of your gastrointestinal system. It is so complex, containing more neurons than your spinal cord, that scientists often refer to it as your second brain.
But let's get back to the pedals.
Right. Think of the accelerator pedal and the brake pedal of your car. The accelerator pedal represents the sympathetic nervous system, and the brake represents the parasympathetic nervous system.
Let's talk about the gas pedal first. That's what you guys call the accelerator, don't you?
We do. The sympathetic system is our fight or flight mode. Imagine you are standing at the start line of a local 10K or the swim start. You feel those pre-race jitters. That is your sympathetic nervous system springing into action to keep you safe. It prepares you for the physical demand ahead by flooding you with adrenaline, opening your lungs, and pumping fuel into your blood.
And your breathing changes as well?
Dramatically. Your breathing rate increases. Your airways actually relax and open up in a process called bronchodilation to let in more oxygen. It even dilates your pupils so you can clearly focus on the trail ahead. And it breaks down stored fat and glycogen to give you immediate energy.
Have you ever noticed that you look pale right before a hard race? That is your sympathetic system constricting the blood vessels in your skin and digestion. It shunts all that blood directly to the deep muscles of your legs that desperately need it.
So, we often give this sympathetic system a bad reputation because we associate it with chronic stress. But as an athlete, you absolutely need it.
You have to have it. It is the beautiful, raw energy that lets you push your limits. But you cannot drive a Ferrari with the accelerator pinned to the floor all day long.
Which brings us to the parasympathetic system. This is your brake pedal, affectionately known as the rest and digest system.
Think about that glorious feeling a few hours after your long Sunday run. You've showered, you've had a great meal, you sink deeply into your couch. That heavy, peaceful feeling washing over you is your parasympathetic brake taking over.
Biologically, it undoes the effects of the stressful workout. It decreases your heart rate. It slows your breathing. It gets your digestion moving again so you can process the food you just ate. It relies heavily on the vagus nerve, a massive nerve highway from your brain to your belly. When stimulated, it tells your body that you are safe.
The thing that I think a lot of folks don't realize is that you don't get fitter during the workout. A workout is just a demolition event. You only adapt, grow, and become stronger during recovery.
Yes, and that rebuilding is 100% driven by your parasympathetic brake pedal.
Let me make sure I've got this right. Our autonomic nervous system really has three branches working together. First, the sympathetic system is the accelerator. It orchestrates our action, stress, and survival.
Exactly. And the parasympathetic system is the brake pedal. But it doesn't just restore energy. It acts as the mechanic. It repairs the muscle tears, lowers inflammation, and tells the body it's safe to heal.
And then there's the enteric system, our second brain, in the gut. It manages the incredibly complex job of processing our fuel. But here's the kicker for athletes. The enteric system relies on that parasympathetic safe signal to actually do its job properly.
Right. If you are constantly stressed and riding the accelerator, your gut shuts down. You can't absorb your fuel if you aren't engaging the brake.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But there is a massive glitch in this ancient hardware, isn't there?
Yes, a huge blind spot. Our autonomic nervous system evolved thousands of years ago to keep us safe from immediate physical dangers, like running away from a predator.
And yet it seems to me that a stress response is what I get from an overflowing email inbox.
But to your body, they are the exact same thing. Your nervous system doesn't know the difference between a hard 10K race, sitting in terrible traffic, or a tense meeting at work. They all trigger that sympathetic fight-or-flight gas pedal.
Which brings us to a visual I find incredibly helpful. It's to imagine that we have just one stress bucket.
Exactly. You do not have a training stress bucket and a separate life stress bucket. You only have one single bucket that holds all the stress you experience.
Let's imagine a typical Tuesday for a passionate, high-achieving athlete. You wake up early, rush to get the kids out the door, and dive into an 8-hour workday. You have looming deadlines, tough meetings, and the weight of responsibility. All day long, your nervous system is slowly dripping stress into your bucket.
And by 5:30 p.m., your bucket might already be 90% full.
Right! And what do? Because we are driven, we rush home, down an espresso, and head out for a grueling track session.
You try to pour a massive amount of physical stress into a bucket that is already brimming. The result? The bucket overflows. Your sympathetic nervous system gets jammed in the on position. Your parasympathetic brake never gets the chance to do its healing work.
And this is where athletes hit a plateau. We feel flat, so we assume the training plan is wrong. We think we need to push harder or add more intervals.
But the science says the exact opposite. Elite endurance coach Alan Cousins notes that when an athlete stops getting fitter, 9 times out of 10, an increase in life stress is to blame. And Dr. Marco Altini's research on heart rate variability backs this up entirely. Physiological data often shows a much stronger relationship with work stress, or poor sleep, than with the actual training itself.
If your bucket is full from the office, your body simply cannot absorb a heavy training stimulus, which means how we manage our minds during the workday is critical. If we can learn to upgrade our mental operating system, which we will talk about later when we dive into positive intelligence, we can actually stop that bucket from filling up so fast.
Yes, I love that. But until you learn to manage that workday stress, you have to respect the bucket you have today. I want to offer everyone listening a massive dose of grace right now. If you have ever felt completely wiped out after a day of sitting at a desk, and your judge says, "I shouldn't be this tired, I haven't even worked out yet," you need to know that you are not weak. Your nervous system has been running a marathon all day long just managing your life stress.
You have to respect the entire bucket. Your body can only adapt at the rate its total stress level allows.
Exactly. If your life stress is exceptionally high 1 week, the most athletic, beneficial choice you can make is to dial back the intensity, taking an easy, restorative run instead of heavy intervals when your bucket is full. That is how you protect your fitness and set yourself up for long-term success.
I want to pause here because I want to make sure we are expressing this next point with absolute clarity. The entire motivation for this episode actually came from an interview I heard. It was endurance coach Gordo Byrne, guesting on Michael Erickson's excellent That Triathlon Show.
Oh, I love Gordo. He is a legend, and Michael's podcast is stellar.
I completely agree. And something that Gordo said really stood out for me. He said that an athlete can get a massive edge over their competition by strengthening and managing their nervous system.
Yes, and when people hear get an edge, they usually think of buying carbon-plated shoes. Or a lighter bike, or finding some secret interval workout, but this is way different.
I think Gordo was describing a profound physiological shift. He was talking about the shift from being an athlete who simply survives their training to an athlete who actively absorbs it.
Surviving versus absorbing, that is a massive distinction.
It is everything. I think Gordo is saying that the true edge is the ability to show up to your most important training sessions with a completely full battery. And this is where our listener, the busy, high-achieving amateur, gets into trouble. If you are constantly stressing your nervous system at work without properly managing it, you risk starting every single hard workout with a battery that is already drained to 70%, or even less.
You might still push through. You might grit your teeth and finish the track session.
But the quality of your effort will be lower, and the physical cost to your body will be so much higher.
In sports science, we call this allostatic load. It refers to the cumulative wear and tear on the body from all sources of stress. In that podcast, Gordo reflected on his younger athletic self and realized he was falling into a massive trap. The trap of maladaptive loading.
Maladaptive loading. Does that mean his training dose was wrong?
It means the total stress you are experiencing exceeds your body's ability to recover. Gordo realized that piling more training intensity on top of existing life fatigue isn't actually leading to the adaptations we want.
It's just straining.
I want to make sure we are being incredibly precise here. When we talk about maladaptive loading, what is the actual root cause? Because it feels like the real issue is the fact that we are starting the workout before we are fully recovered from yesterday's stress.
Spot on, John. You hit the nail on the head. The root cause of maladaptive loading is the biological state of your body before you even tie your shoelaces. If your stress bucket is already full from a bad night's sleep or a brutal week at the office, any hard training you add is maladaptive. You are applying stress to a system that hasn't finished repairing itself.
Right. So the lack of recovery is the real culprit. Where does straying into the grey zone fit into this?
The lack of recovery is the match, John. The grey zone is how we pour gasoline on the fire. Because we are tired and stressed, our internal saboteurs are more deadly. We feel flat, so our inner judge tells us we are losing our fitness.
So instead of taking a much-needed rest day, or keeping the run strictly in an easy, regenerative zone one, we drift into that moderately hard grey zone just to prove to ourselves that we can still sweat.
Exactly. We rack up a massive amount of pointless sympathetic stress. We pay a huge nervous system cost for zero physiological gain, and we completely guarantee that we won't be recovered for tomorrow's workout either.
So the primary error is ignoring the fatigue, and the secondary error is letting the saboteurs drag us into the grey zone instead of actually resting. Speaking of resting, this looks like our episode is going long course today, so let's grab a break. Here is 2 minutes of Nervous Traffic by the Electro Animals. It's at 94 beats per minute if you want to sync your cadence. Welcome back, everyone. I want to explore why we all find it so hard to go easy on the easy days.
Because we are listening to the lie in our own self-talk. This is where positive intelligence, or PQ, changes everything. The typical loudest voices are usually the judge and the hyperachiever. But look out for the stickler and controller, too. They look at your watch and say, "This pace is embarrassing. What if someone sees you on Strava?" Or, "Your training plan must be rubbish, this can't be helping." The judge tells you that if you aren't suffering, you aren't worthy. It tells you that easy equals lazy.
This second-guessing the workout and beating yourself up for going so slow adds to your sympathetic stress. So now you drift to running too fast, and you are mentally stressed while doing it. You are completely short-circuiting your body's ability to adapt.
So I want to leave everyone with a very gentle, but very firm message. Mental toughness isn't about hating yourself through a grueling workout. Sometimes, true mental toughness is having the profound discipline and the self-love to go truly easy.
The courage to go slow?
Yes. Learn PQ and silence the judge. Keep your easy days truly easy.
So going back to Gordo's Edge, he is advocating that all of us shift entirely to adaptive loading. This is the sweet spot of sustainable training. It is a perfectly measured dose of physical stress that disrupts your body's baseline. but it is a dose that your parasympathetic nervous system can completely absorb.
And when Gordo speaks about strengthening the nervous system, he doesn't mean making yourself tougher, does he? He doesn't mean gritting your teeth through more pain?
Not at all. He means making your nervous system more resilient and elastic. A truly strong nervous system acts like our beautifully tuned sports car. It can snap instantly into that high-intensity, sympathetic fight-or-flight mode when you need to surge up a steep hill.
And it can immediately drop into deep, peaceful relaxation the moment the effort is done. Optimal performance in endurance sports relies entirely on this elasticity, the ability to switch quickly and smoothly between your body's accelerator and its brake.
It seems to me that in order to show up rested with that battery at 100%, athletes really need to pay far more attention to the total stress in their lives. We all need to become far better at diffusing workplace and family stress so it's not filling up that bucket.
Exactly. Don't you feel that the edge Gordo wants us to find is unlocked with PQ?
Yes, I do agree. But how do we know we're rested? How can an athlete tell if their battery is recharged and ready for adaptation? I thought measuring the nervous system was notoriously difficult.
It is incredibly tricky, John. It's made complicated as you cannot always rely on how you subjectively feel. You will not necessarily feel dominant sympathetic fatigue. While we humans are absolutely brilliant at sensing acute pain in the middle of a VO2 max interval, we are surprisingly terrible at recognizing chronic, systemic fatigue. Life stress can be invidious and incremental. When this cumulative load builds up, we usually cannot feel our parasympathetic rest and digest system going onto the back foot because our autonomic nervous system cleverly masks it by pumping out stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol to keep us functioning.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that happened.
I know. Instead of feeling profoundly exhausted right away, you might actually feel hyperactive, restless, or kind of wired. Because this stress creeps in by mere fractions of a percent each day, we simply normalize the low-grade lethargy and forget what true freshness actually feels like.
This is where we need a compass. We need a way to look inside the body and see what the nervous system is actually doing before we ever lace up our shoes. And thankfully, we have one. It is called heart rate variability, or HRV. Tracking HRV is the modern progression from checking your morning resting heart rate, which athletes did for decades. We used to assume that as long as your resting heart rate was low, your parasympathetic brake was working perfectly, and you were good to go.
Right, but resting heart rate is a blunt instrument. It tells us how many times the engine turns over in a minute, but it completely misses the hidden stress humming beneath the surface. Let's do a very quick high-level look at what HRV is. A healthy heart does not beat like a perfect metronome. If your heart rate is 60 beats per minute, there are microscopic variations, fractions of a second between those beats. These tiny fluctuations are directly controlled by your autonomic nervous system.
So, is HRV a way to understand the balance between the accelerator and the brake?
It is. When your sympathetic accelerator pedal is jammed down due to stress, your heart rhythm becomes very rigid and constant. Your HRV goes down. But when your parasympathetic brake is engaged and you are beautifully relaxed, there is a lot more variability between the beats. Your HRV goes up.
Now, a massive word of caution here, because we know our listeners. They are going to immediately look at their smartwatches. HRV is incredibly promising, but only when the data is collected properly with a validated device.
I cannot stress that enough. Do not just blindly trust a random gadget. If you want to use this, we highly encourage you to go to hrv4training.com. That is the work of Dr. Marco Altini, a leading researcher in this field. Look up how to collect the data properly. Best practice is usually first thing in the morning, under controlled conditions.
And when you start measuring it, I need you to leave your saboteurs at the door. HRV is not a high score you are trying to beat. You cannot compare your score to your training partner's score. What we are looking for is your personal normal range.
So, what happens when you wake up and your score has plummeted below that normal range?
That is your nervous system waving a massive red flag. It means your stress bucket is overflowing, maybe from a huge workout, maybe from poor sleep, or a terribly stressful day at the office. It is your body telling you it is already fighting a battle.
which brings us to the ultimate skepticism of the driven athlete. It requires a massive leap of faith to wake up, feel somewhat okay, but have a tool tell you to skip your planned intervals. The no pain, no gain mentality rebels against this.
It does, but the science is absolutely irrefutable. Dr. Altini points to some incredible studies involving runners and cyclists. Researchers split the athletes into two groups. The first group followed a traditional, rigid training plan. They did the hard intervals no matter what.
The typical type A approach.
Exactly. The second group was HRV guided. They followed the exact same plan. But if they woke up and their HRV was suppressed, they scaled the hard session down to an easy spin or took a rest day.
And this is the part I love. Because they skipped sessions when they were stressed, the HRV-guided group actually completed fewer high-intensity workouts. But at the end of the study, the HRV-guided runners had a 5% greater increase in performance, and the HRV-guided cyclists saw a massive 7% greater improvement.
And the rigid group?
The group that stubbornly pushed through their fatigue saw almost no improvement at all.
If you need scientific permission to skip a hard workout when you are drained, this is it. This teaches you the ultimate lesson of endurance sports. You can only train the body you woke up with today, not the body you wish you had, not the body Training Peaks expects you to have.
Well, given all we've heard today, we have to conclude that it was worse than pointless for the no matter what group to power through. Adaptation would be suppressed. So why do it? They were never going to get anything from those workouts other than deeper fatigue.
I think there's a quote from Alan Cousins that sums this all up. No recovery, no response.
So, Emily has her daily compass. We are checking our HRV, noting any upward trends in our resting heart rate, and tuning into our autonomic nervous system health. Now, I want to examine our obsession with intensity. It seems to me that every online coach is selling themselves on working magic with time-crunched or time-starved athletes. It looks like many coaches are happy to exchange time for intensity. And you can see why. When you drop from a pro level 20 plus hours a week down to a recreational athlete's available 8 to 10 hours, you simply cannot maintain a strict 80-20 polarized split. The low intensity volume in a 10-hour week isn't always enough to build the sheer metabolic durability required to survive a 140.6-mile day.
What the high-intensity, time-crunched plans are successfully triggering are short-term peripheral adaptations. By doing hard intervals, you rapidly improve neuromuscular firing and teach your body how to buffer lactic acid. This gives the time-crunched athlete a very quick, exciting boost in fitness. However, these short-term adaptations have a very limited shelf life and will quickly plateau.
Why I bring this up now is that we've discussed our one biological bucket for stress. A busy professional trying to squeeze Ironman training into 10 hours is likely already dealing with a demanding job, family responsibilities, and a lack of sleep. Their sympathetic nervous system is already switched on all day.
High-intensity training, zones 4 and 5, is highly catabolic, meaning it actively breaks the body's systems down and floods the body with stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. If an athlete's life stress is already filling their bucket to 90%, and a coach pours intense sweet spot and threshold sessions on top of it to make up for a lack of volume, the bucket overflows. The athlete's parasympathetic nervous system never gets a chance to engage.
It is the great paradox of endurance sports, John. When we lace up our shoes, we want to feel like we are working hard, but the foundation of your fitness, the massive engine that will eventually allow you to fly, it is built almost entirely at a conversational, relaxed pace.
We call this zones 1 and 2 in a 5-zone model, or the green zone. And the reason this slow, easy training is so magical comes down to profound structural changes inside your body. First, you are literally growing a bigger heart. It's called cardiac remodeling.
Wait, is that true? We expand the size of our heart?
Yes, literally stretching the walls of the heart chambers. This won't happen in a 20-week couch to Ironman plan, but over years of consistent aerobic training, an endurance athlete's heart can almost double in total volume. And another fascinating part is, your heart achieves its maximum stretch at a relatively low intensity, around 60% of your maximum effort.
Going any harder doesn't stretch the heart any further. It just makes it beat faster. By staying in the easy green zone, you signal those heart walls to hold more blood. So eventually, you can run at much higher speeds while keeping your heart rate wonderfully low.
And at the same time, you are building thousands of microscopic energy factories inside your muscles, your mitochondria. And you are teaching your body to become incredibly efficient at burning fat for fuel instead of burning precious sugar.
But Scott, Emily, here is the problem. Those adaptations take years, don't they? And we do live in a world of magazine covers promising a couch to Ironman in 6 months, or the Ironman in 8 hours a week CEO training plan.
Oh, those plans are incredibly tempting. And we want to be clear, they are not inherently wrong. They do produce short-term results, but we have to look at the long-term biological cost for that busy professional.
You cannot hack or rush a bigger heart with high-intensity intervals.
It just seems to me that there's an elephant in the room that we haven't talked about. So far, our focus has been about the individual choices we make, how we manage life stress, or how we spend too much time in the grey zone. But I think we need to turn a slightly critical eye on the endurance industry itself, because we do see magazines and coaching sites promoting these 10 hours a week to a sub-10 Ironman plans.
Yes, it's sold as the ultimate quick fix for the busy athlete.
Exactly. And to understand why these plans exist, we have to look at exactly who is buying them. When we look at the data for amateur long course triathletes, it paints a very specific picture of a highly driven demographic managing a mountain of real-world responsibility. It seems that participation is about 60 to 65% male. The largest age groups are consistently 35 to 44 and 45 to 54.
Right, that's men in the prime of their careers, probably with significant family responsibilities.
Precisely. It is also an affluent group, with average household incomes frequently exceeding £100,000. And for completeness, we'd have to say long course triathlon has historically lacked diversity, remaining roughly 80% white, although the governing bodies are actively working to change this. So, you have a cash-rich, time-poor demographic that is highly driven by external success. They don't have 20 hours a week, but they have the disposable income to buy a plan that promises a physiological hack.
And John, what they are buying is a physiological Faustian bargain, because you cannot build a massive, fat-burning aerobic engine on 10 hours a week. It requires profound, slow volume over years. So to compensate, these 10-hour plans inject massive amounts of high-intensity threshold work to force the cardiovascular adaptations quickly.
These plans are a form of physiological cramming. And we know what happens when you pour intense sympathetic nervous system stress into the bucket of a 45-year-old executive. The bucket violently overflows. They might break the 10-hour barrier on race day, but their endocrine system is shattered. They might spend months in a state of chronic stress, risking profound burnout.
Which I think explains one of the most tragic statistics in the sport. An estimated 55% of first-timers never return for a second full Ironman. They are one and done.
I think many are prepared to pay that price as they approach the race purely as a bucket list item. And in positive intelligence, we know that for many what's driving that is their hyperachiever saboteur. The hyperachiever makes your self-respect and sense of self-worth dependent on externals. The finisher's medal, the social media post, the dinner party wow, and of course the tattoo.
So if the 10-hour Ironman plan is the playground for the hyperachiever, where do we find the antidote?
You find it out on the trails. You find it with the ultra runners. Think about a 100-mile trail race in the mountains. You can't just sign up for the biggest 100-mile races on a whim. There is a massive qualification funnel. You have to spend years running 50Ks and spending long, slow days on the trails just to qualify.
It's a great point, Emily. In many ways, the ultra runner is actually forced to obey the laws of human physiology. By spending all that time in the low-intensity green zone, they quietly build the massive, fat-burning engine required to actually absorb the stress of the distance.
But the most beautiful difference is the psychology. Ironman is highly controlled. You stare at your bike computer, obsessing over exact wattage. It is a playground for your inner stickler and controller saboteurs. But a 100-mile trail run strips all of that away. You cannot control the mud, the weather, or the altitude.
Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C, they all go out the window.
Exactly. So to survive an ultra, you are almost forced to adopt the sage perspective. The sage operates from a place of deep empathy, curiosity, and acceptance. When an ultra runner gets to mile 60 and their stomach rebels, they don't panic and let the judge beat them up. They sit on a rock, they eat some potato chips, they problem solve with curiosity, and they keep moving. There's no pretense of the controller here. They just work with what is. And I think that deep self-compassion keeps the parasympathetic brake engaged, saving them massive amounts of energy.
So the takeaway here isn't that you have to quit triathlon and become an ultra runner. It's more that we need to borrow the ultra runner's sage mindset.
Absolutely not. Triathlon's mix of sports can be super healthy, enriching, and so life-affirming. But there is real value in looking at what makes ultra runners tick. Did you know that something like 35% of 100-mile runners will DNF? For some people, it takes maybe 2 or 3 attempts to actually complete one. I think it's far more about lifestyle and far less about the bucket list. To me, it looks like they don't just train for a medal, they live athletically.
So how do we coach the highly driven type A personality? If we tell them to go slow and build a base for 3 years, they will lose their minds with boredom.
Well, I want to say that we show them that their self-worth is not in any way related to external achievement, that they are worthy of love no matter what. So they have the same intrinsic value as a human being if they get a sub-10 time or a DNF. But I don't think that's what you mean.
You're right. It's not the answer I was expecting, Emily, but it's a great answer. Let's play yes and for a moment. So yes, they are worthy of unconditional self-acceptance and the underlying strength of the hyperachiever is achieving. These athletes have a gift for achieving and goals can be healthy and give us steps and direction towards what we value. Achieving is going to be very helpful in living a flourishing life. So what's a way to achieve in a healthy, sustainable, fun, ease and flow kind of way?
I love that, John. One way is to have them change the scoreboard. High achievers are incredibly driven by metrics and progress. We've talked about HRV score already, so let's introduce them to efficiency factor.
Efficiency factor, or EF, is a brilliant metric. It is incredibly simple. It's your average power, or pace, divided by your average heart rate. We tell the athlete, your goal for the next 9 months is not to see how fast you can go. It is to see how efficiently you can produce power.
It turns going slow into a highly engaging biological game. You are tracking your body's ability to burn fat. You are watching your heart rate stay perfectly relaxed while your wattage slowly climbs.
And if anyone is worried that this means giving up on being truly fast, we just have to look at the greatest champions in the world.
Absolutely. Look at former marathon world record holder Paula Radcliffe. Over 11 years of training, the raw size of her aerobic engine didn't actually change much at all. But her running economy, how efficiently her body used oxygen, improved by an astonishing 15%. Running economy is deeply structural, metabolic, and neuromuscular. It has a nearly limitless runway for improvement, but it demands patience. It is improved by years and years of cumulative, consistent volume that creates microscopic adaptations. For example, mitochondrial density, building more cellular powerhouses in the slow-twitch muscle fibers to process oxygen and burn fat more efficiently. Tendon stiffness, developing the Achilles and lower leg tendons to act like incredibly stiff, efficient springs. And neuromuscular tuning. The brain and nervous system learn to fire the exact right muscle fibers at the exact right millisecond, eliminating any wasted lateral or vertical movement.
Dr. Andrew Jones's study of Paula Radcliffe brilliantly shows exactly what we're talking about. You can maximize your VO2 engine relatively quickly with punishing high-intensity intervals, but you simply cannot rush the 10-year slow-bake development of running economy. Efficiency is forged in the quiet consistency of daily miles.
Okay, so let's take a short break here and come back to try and wrap this up. This is 2 minutes of Danger Zone by Loopslab. We'll be right back. Welcome back, team. Now, I have a few questions. Let me start with this one. Are we saying that high-intensity training or going hard is actually wrong? Because we've spent a lot of time talking about the magic of the brake pedal.
We have, but the reality is, not at all. High-intensity interval training, or HIIT, is absolutely fantastic. You need it to reach your full potential. Your sympathetic nervous system, the accelerator pedal, needs to be trained just like a muscle. The catch is the dosage and the timing. The world's best endurance athletes use a polarized training model. This means a massive 80 to 90% of their training is purely easy and comfortable. Only 10 to 20% is dedicated to those hard, sympathetic-driven intervals.
Which brings me to my second skeptical question. And this is a big one for the high achievers listening. If I am not suffering, am I even getting fitter? Going easy just feels lazy.
But let's look at the biology. When you do that easy zone 1 and zone 2 training, where you can comfortably hold a conversation, you are actually performing the most important construction work your body can do. You are physically stretching the walls of your heart. You are building those mitochondrial factories. None of those profound adaptations happen when you are pushing yourself to the point of pain.
Building the foundation of your fitness does not require suffering. Think of the sage's ease and flow.
Okay, question 3. The busy professional trap we talked about. I only have 45 minutes to ride my bike today between meetings. Shouldn't I just go as hard as I can for those 45 minutes to make it count and get a good sweat going?
This is the trap that catches almost every recreational athlete trying to balance a job and a sport. This is the mindset that too often drops you into the grey zone we talked about earlier. It feels like a solid, moderately hard effort.
But, as we've learned, you are generating fatigue without generating fitness. By pushing that short ride into a moderately hard effort, you spike your sympathetic stress response. But you aren't going hard enough to get the true cardiovascular benefits of a high-intensity interval training session.
You end up paying a high nervous system cost for a very minimal physiological reward. It is the exact definition of junk miles.
Exactly. Keep the easy days easy and the hard days hard.
All right, final question for the skeptics. What if I actually feel amazing when I train hard every day? Why on earth should I change if I feel good?
This is perhaps the most deceptive trick the body plays on the high-achieving athlete. When you train at a high intensity, your body releases a cascade of stress hormones. Adrenaline and cortisol?
Neurochemically, this acts as a literal stimulant. It gives you a feeling of euphoria. Sometimes it's known as fatigue intoxication.
But here's what is happening beneath the surface. Your sympathetic nervous system recovers its ability to do work much faster than your parasympathetic system recovers its ability to switch off. Because you are riding a wave of stress hormones, your brain tricks you into believing you are ready for more.
Even when you are not?
Exactly. If you keep chasing that daily high, the gap between your stress system and your recovery system widens. Eventually, your parasympathetic baseline drops so low that the euphoria turns into agitation. It turns into sleep deprivation and a physical hole that is incredibly tough to climb out of.
Just because the accelerator feels exhilarating doesn't mean the engine isn't quietly overheating.
Okay, so let's agree that we can see real value in something like a 16-week training plan that specifically leads to a race. In other words, a training plan that kind of sits on top of a much more general continuous athletic lifestyle. Let's finish by painting a clearer picture of the rest of the year, the time outside of the race build.
Okay, I agree. If we want a race, then there's a process of performance sharpening. It's designed to gradually become ever more like the performance we want to deliver on race day. But for me, it's much better to think of racing as icing sugar on the cake. But it's the cake that's the real deal.
So I'd urge the listener to transition from their goal being all about maximizing their performance on a single day to the goal of sustaining their capability for decades. If I was looking at an idealized year, I'd start with a massive reset. I know that Alan Cousins strongly advises taking a 4 to 6 week block every single year where you completely shut down structured training.
6 weeks? The listener just broke into a cold sweat. They are thinking, I will lose all my fitness.
I know. The saboteurs are screaming right now.
But you have to do this to cure the deep, central nervous system fatigue that builds up over a season. You don't sit on the couch for 6 weeks. You simply move for joy. You put away the heart rate monitor. You ignore the training zones.
If you don't reset the nervous system, you physically cannot improve when you start training again.
Okay, so we take our annual reset. When we do resume our base training lifestyle, what does the weekly rhythm look like?
Well, you could do worse than look at a 5-2 method. You train for 5 days and you take 2 consecutive days completely off. Not active recovery, completely off.
For the recreational athlete, this provides a profound physiological reset. It ensures that your parasympathetic nervous system, the brake pedal, engages fully.
And it allows you to be a present partner, a present parent, and friend. It ensures your sport enriches your life rather than isolating you.
All right, so we are resting 2 days a week. On the 5 days we are moving, is it all slow and easy?
Mostly yes. About 80 to 90% of your training time should be in that conversational green zone. But it is definitely not all slow. You have to keep the roof high.
Keep the roof high? Can you just explain that?
Again, quoting Alan Cousins, he points out a fascinating biological rule. He says, the anaerobic fibers of today are the aerobic fibers of tomorrow. If you want to eventually push 300 watts or run a fast pace effortlessly, you first need the raw muscular strength to hit those numbers. Two ways to do that are strength training, muscle moves stuff, so lifting heavy weights helps. Secondly, try some lactic speed work.
That might be a new term for the listener, but I love lactic speed work. Think of it as easy speed. It means doing very short, maximal bursts, like 10 to 15 second hill sprints, followed by walking recovery.
Because the sprints are so short, they don't produce crushing amounts of lactic acid. They don't fry your nervous system, but they beautifully maintain your neuromuscular coordination and your running economy.
So we are doing some strength work, doing a few 15-second sprints, and spending the rest of the time cruising in the green zone.
Exactly. And John, this is the most liberating part of the whole philosophy. Because you aren't tied to highly stressful intervals, you have the freedom to explore. You have permission to play. Go mountain biking with friends, or map out an epic 6-hour cycling route to a cafe you've never visited. Because you are staying in the green zone, the only limit is how much time you have and how much food you can eat. And it builds to the ultimate vision. Gordo Byrne warns us, as you get older, your world gets smaller. And he means if you lose your fitness, your world shrinks to what is immediately around you.
But by adopting this year-round endurance lifestyle, respecting weekly rest days, doing some strength work, and exploring the green zone,
you are actively rebelling against that shrinking world. You are building a body that guarantees when you are 80 years old, and you are looking out over the edge of the Grand Canyon. You have the absolute freedom and the capability to hike right down into it. That is what this journey is truly all about.
That image of the Grand Canyon, that really is the ultimate why, isn't it? It's not about a plastic medal or a finishing time on a spreadsheet.
No. It is about absolute freedom. It is about having a body that says yes to whatever adventure your heart wants to take.
So, as we bring this episode of the MindFit Athlete to a close, let's quickly summarize the ideas we've been playing with today.
It all comes back to the wiring of the machine. You have a Ferrari engine, but you only have one stress bucket. If you are constantly redlining your sympathetic accelerator pedal at work and then redlining it again in your training, you will inevitably overheat and break down. You have to engage the brake. You have to let the parasympathetic nervous system do its beautiful restorative work.
And to do that, you have to defeat some invisible opponents.
Yes, you have to intercept those saboteurs. You have to actively quiet the judge and silence the hyperachiever. Because I want to say something directly to the passionate, driven people listening right now.
Go ahead, Emily.
Your worth as a human being and your worth as an athlete is not determined by how much you suffer on a Tuesday evening track session. You do not have to earn your rest.
Biology actually demands it. Rest is where the magic happens. It is where the fitness is built.
Exactly. So I want to challenge everyone listening today. This week, when you look at your training plan and you feel that familiar anxiety creeping in, that pressure to go harder,
to skip your rest day, to drift into the gray zone just to prove you are working hard. Take a deep breath. Activate your PQ Sage. Be kind to that little kid inside of you. Choose deep self-compassion over self-punishment. Give yourself the profound courage to go easy and the absolute grace to rest.
Because that is where the true edge is found. That is how you shift from merely surviving your training to actually absorbing it. You train for life, not just for a finish line.
And you quietly build an unstoppable, lifelong engine in the process.
What a brilliant, liberating way to approach the sport we love. Emily, Scott, thank you both for such an incredibly powerful conversation today.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
Keep smiling out there, everyone. Embrace the beautiful green zone.
Speaking of edges, if you'd like to delve deeper into this kind of content, you are very welcome to take our free 4-part Mental Edge course. You'll find it on the mindfitathlete.com homepage, and you don't even need to give us your email. I've been John, and thank you so much for listening to The MindFit Athlete.
Thank you for tuning in to the MindFit Athlete podcast. If you've enjoyed today's material and you'd like to dive deeper, our MindFit Athlete community is waiting for you over at mindfitathlete.com. That's where we take these insights and integrate them into our everyday lives. In fact, we're on a mission to help everyone build their mental fitness so they can choose happiness, thrive, and make a positive difference. We are building our mental fitness in sport and in life, and we'd absolutely love to have you join us.